This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janat Jalil, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 29th of September, these are our main stories. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu describes the killing of the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah as a historic turning point. Hezbollah says the loss of its leader will not stop it from fighting on. President Biden has said it's time for a ceasefire. And Saudi Arabia has now carried out nearly 200 executions this year, the highest number in more than three decades. Also in this podcast, is Austria's far right poised for a historic win in Sunday's elections?
It would be a totally new situation in the history of the Second Republic, because the Freedom Party came close a couple of times, but was never in first place, at least not in the general election.
The Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has called the killing of the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah a historic turning point. Nasrallah, who'd not been seen in public for years because of assassination fears, was killed by a massive Israeli airstrike on Beirut on Friday. Hours later, Hezbollah confirmed his death. It described him as a martyr and vowed to carry on its fight against Israel. Mr. Netanyahu said his elimination was a necessary condition for achieving Israel's war goals.
Medinat Israel chisla etmol et rav ha-meratzchim Hassan Nasrallah.
The state of Israel on Friday eliminated the mass murderer Hassan Nasrallah. We settled the score with the one responsible for the murder of countless Israelis and many citizens of other countries, including hundreds of Americans and dozens of French. Nasrallah's elimination is an essential condition to achieve the goals we have set.
Mr. Netanyahu was speaking on his return home from the UN General Assembly in New York. President Biden, for his part, has described Israel's killing of Hassan Nasrallah as a measure of justice for his victims, which included hundreds of Americans as well as thousands of Israelis and Lebanese civilians. At the same time, he's urged a ceasefire. Jenny Kumar reports from Washington.
President Biden's comments reiterate his consistent message since the Gaza conflict began, that the US stands by Israel whilst also emphasising the need for a diplomatic solution. He said Nasrallah and his group had been responsible for killing hundreds of Americans during what Mr. Biden called a four-decade reign of terror. Nasrallah's death, the president said, was a measure of justice for his many victims. Although there's a sense of growing tension in the White House over Israel's defiance, Mr. Biden stopped short of any criticism.
Jenny Kumar in Washington. But as fears grow of a wider war across the Middle East, there's been widespread condemnation of Nasrallah's killing from leaders across the region. These mourners gathered outside a mosque in Beirut.
He is a father and a brother to us. He means everything to us. He is like a son and a brother to me. He embodies dignity, pride, honour and gallantry. He taught us to never be defeated.
I heard more from Chantal Hartle on the reaction across the Middle East to the death of Hassan Nasrallah.
The deputy leader of Hamas, Khalil al-Haya, said that Nasrallah's killing would trigger a new stage of sacred revenge for all the blood that had been shed. There was comment from the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas. He condemned the brutal Israeli aggression, as he called it. The Iran-backed Houthis in Yemen said the Israeli strike had strengthened their determination to confront the Israeli enemy. And the group also said that it had fired a ballistic missile at Israel's main airport, which was timed to coincide with Benjamin Netanyahu's arrival back into Israel from the United States. And there was also strong words from the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. He said that Lebanon was being subjected to a genocide without actually referring directly to Hassan Nasrallah.
And what's the response been elsewhere?
Well, there's been reaction across Europe. In Germany, Berlin said that the destabilization of Lebanon was not in Israel's security interest. Russia's foreign ministry has also condemned the killing of the Hezbollah leader. The Argentine president, Javier Milei, reposted on X a message from a member of his Council of Economic Advisers, David Epstein, who had hailed the killing. And that message read, "Israel eliminated one of the greatest contemporary murderers, responsible, among others, for the cowardly attacks in Argentina." And it said, "Today the world is a little freer." And finally, the UN chief Antonio Guterres has also released a statement saying the violence in Lebanon must end now.
Chantal Hartl. I put it to our Middle East regional editor, Mike Thompson, that the assassination of Hassan Nasrallah was a big moment, not just for the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah, but for the wider region.
Pivotal, hugely significant, this. We've had almost a year of cross-border fire between Hezbollah and Israel. Then it progressed to the sabotaging of pagers and handheld radios, killing dozens of Hezbollah commanders. And now this, the assassination of a figure who's revered right across the Shia population of the Middle East. And that could drag in other countries like Yemen, Iraq, Syria, as well, of course, as Iran itself.
And Israel has been trying for decades to kill Hassan Nasrallah. Tell us what we know about how they finally managed to achieve this.
Israeli intelligence said that they did get some really good intelligence on where the Hezbollah command center was in the Dahiya southern suburb of Beirut. And while the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was in New York at the UN, speaking quite fiercely about Israel wouldn't stop till it achieved its objectives, bombs were landing and hitting the Hezbollah command center.
And Israel has made it very clear that this isn't the end of the matter as far as it's concerned. The Israeli military says it's killed a senior member of Hezbollah's intelligence as well. In fact, in the past few weeks, Israel has wiped out virtually all the Hezbollah military commanders who could have replaced Hassan Nasrallah.
Yes, indeed. It's been a series of this going on, as I said, with those pagers and handheld radios. A lot of senior Hezbollah people died there. And then we've had various strikes which have killed, I think the most recent one up to Friday was the guy who arranged strikes, according to the Israeli military anyway, arranged strikes on Israel. So it's been an ongoing campaign and it's not going to stop.
Mike Thompson. Well, Iran, Hezbollah's main backer, which provides many of its weapons, has declared 5 days of public mourning for the Hezbollah leader. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, said Hassan Nasrallah's death would not go unavenged. A senior member of Iran's Revolutionary Guards was also killed in the Israeli attacks on Beirut on Friday. Parham Gobadi from the BBC Persian Service told us about the significance of what Iran's supreme leader had to say.
He issued a statement, a written statement, in which he said that Hassan Nasrallah's blood would not go unavenged. Well, if you compare that to his previous statements when, I don't know, Haniyeh was assassinated or Iranian General Qasem Soleimani was assassinated in Iraq back in 2020, he always spoke, typically he spoke of harsh punishment, harsh revenge. Well, this time, his tone of this, the tone of the statement was much more restrained compared to the previous ones. There was no talk of harsh revenge. The other thing that was really missing in this statement was that a very high-ranking Iranian Revolutionary Guards commander was killed alongside Nasrallah, and he was not mentioned at all in that statement. So this is one difference. And in July, also Ismail Haniyeh, Hamas leader, was assassinated in Tehran. That was a huge blow and a humiliating blow to Iranian regime. But Iran refrained from taking revenge on that as well. So, you know, when you put all these in a context, you see that Iran appears to be not want to go, you know, to a full-scale war with Israel, because military might and military technology and things like that aside, Iran is grappling with a nation that has social and economic grievances and only 2 years after nationwide protests.
So the fear is for Iran's mullahs that if they try to go for an all-out war, they won't just be facing a foe in Israel, they'll also be facing an enemy within, with their own people who are very unhappy with their rule.
That's correct. That's correct. So one of the things that right now, for example, when Ismail Haniyeh was assassinated, even Iranian officials were saying that it's because of the spies that, you know, and this is what Benjamin Netanyahu was talking about it the other day as well. So Israel is winning an intelligence war with Iran. They've shown and they've proven that they have intelligence where Haniyeh was staying in Tehran, where Nasrallah was staying, and where his compound was in Beirut. So they have won the intelligence war with Iran so far.
Paham Gobadi. Well, plumes of smoke were seen rising on Saturday from buildings in Beirut as Israel continued to carry out strikes in Lebanon, including the Hezbollah stronghold of Dahiyeh in the south of the Lebanese capital. Officials say nearly 800 people have died in the past week of intense Israeli airstrikes on Lebanon. Hundreds of thousands of people are reported to have been displaced as residents have fled their homes in panic. Israel, along with the United States and other Western countries, classify Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. Rob Young has been talking to a spokesman from the Israeli Defense Forces, Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner. What does he think the wider impact of Hassan Nasrallah's death will be?
So I would say, first of all, the strike on Nasrallah itself was a critical part of our military operation. There have been many doors out of this step that Nasrallah himself chose not to go through and to continue his aggression and hostility towards Israel. So the targeted strike against the underground headquarters is part, and against him and his senior commanders, the terrorists that were with him, is an absolutely part of our message that we won't allow the ongoing threat to Israeli civilians who have now been living out of home for almost a year, some 60,000 people. And that's why we feel it was absolutely necessary to push forward in order to take Hezbollah and the threat that they pose, including with their long-range strategic precision-guided missiles, off of the table. We've been going through the motions of diplomacy for the last year, and that was, up until this week, the chosen route. But we've reached a new decision, and the government instructed the military to ensure that Israelis will be able to get back home, the 60,000 Israelis. And that's why we conducted a series of strikes.
Rockets are still being fired, though, by Hezbollah in Lebanon into Israel. So what you have been doing so far has not eliminated the threat to Israel. Do you think it will be necessary to send troops into Lebanon?
So Hezbollah has been building its armory, weapons capabilities, its forces for the last 20 years. So there's no quick fix to this development. And indeed, as we speak, there are still rockets coming over. But what I can say is that the strike that conducted against the leadership, and indeed the decapitation of almost all of their senior leaders, commanders, field commanders, operational commanders in the last week, has disrupted their efforts, but not negated and eliminated them completely. So we will see the ongoing actions and ongoing launch of rockets and missiles, and we have even throughout the course of this morning. And of course, the military needs to be prepared for the next stages, and that stage may require ground offensive, ground forces.
More than 700 people in Lebanon have been killed over the past week and a half, according to Lebanon's health minister. This is about allowing 60,000 Israelis to go back to their homes in the north of Israel. Yet we've had well over 100,000 Lebanese forced to flee their homes in the south of Lebanon. What is the price that Israel thinks Lebanon and the Lebanese people should pay to allow Israelis to go back to their homes?
Well, ideally, that question should be reverted to Hezbollah, because they chose on the 8th of October to launch their war on Israel. So all efforts from our perspective continue to be made to minimize civilian harm. All civilian lives in this war that have been lost are tragic. The responsibility for those lives lies squarely with the terrorists who chose to put civilians in harm's way.
Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner. Well, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees says more than 50,000 people have crossed into Syria to escape the Israeli airstrikes. Back in Beirut, the deputy representative of UNICEF Lebanon, Etty Higgins, said the scale of the crisis there was overwhelming.
So it's a really, really catastrophic situation here in Beirut. More than 100,000 people are seeking safety in these shelters, and really the resources are running out by the minute. We just cannot keep up with the level of need. The hospitals have been inundated with those who have been injured. We're flying in emergency medical supplies. We're doing what we can with what we have on the ground, but time is really of the essence given the magnitude of the crisis and the level of injuries that we're dealing with.
On Saturday evening, I spoke to our correspondent in Beirut, Nafise Kunewald, on a busy street. She described the situation where she was.
We are in downtown Beirut, where many families from Dahiyeh, a southern suburb of the city, they had to leave last night and spend their night in this area, take refuge on the streets. And they slept in the street. And along the way that we were coming here, we saw many families, tens of families in the same situation. They only had very short warning, received messages from Israeli army warning them that areas around them will be hit. So they were given notice that they need to leave their houses immediately. And now that I'm talking to you, Janet, it's sunset, and it seems that this will be the second night that they have to spend their night here, because even moments ago, Israeli army spokesperson declared that they are still hitting Dahiyeh, which time to time, despite all the noise around us, we hear explosions coming from southern suburb of the city. There have been at least 5 airstrikes today, despite that they announced that Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, is killed.
And it's not just Lebanese residents who are being displaced, also tens of thousands of Syrian refugees. Beirut is host to many, many Syrian refugees, and there are reports that some of them have gone back to Syria to escape this violence.
Yes, Janet, we witnessed that. When we started reporting from here, we saw some vans, minibuses came, and we all said, where are you going? They were packing their stuff, and they said that we are going back to Syria. And they weren't only Syrians that were choose to go back to Syria. They were some Lebanese also told us that they think so they cannot go back to their houses any soon, so they decided to leave Lebanon to go and take refuge in somewhere in Damascus or anywhere that they can.
And we've just heard from an UN official about the scale of the crisis there. What help is there for the people who can't leave Beirut, who are stuck there but displaced?
From the morning we have been reporting this, and we went to different points of downtown Beirut. All we saw that people just managing their life themselves on the street. There is no help, there is no sign that anyone is coming to help these people that spend their night here. And the reason is, we asked them that, have you tried schools that are accommodating some of the displaced people who came from the south? They said that those were already packed. This is the situation that the Lebanese government and aid organizations are dealing with. And many aid organizations told us that Lebanese government cannot take this burden, is not ready for this, and aid organizations also overwhelmed.
Nafise Kunewald in Beirut. Still to come.
Teams from 38 nations flew to Seoul to take part in the week-long competition, which was first held 2 decades ago. Football's world governing body, FIFA, sponsored the event for the first time this year.
We hear about the Homeless World Cup, a football tournament for people without proper housing held in South Korea. You're listening to the Global News Podcast. Let's turn to Austria now, where a general election on Sunday could see the far-right Freedom Party top the polls for the first time. This is all the more remarkable because 5 years ago, the party crashed out of a coalition government because of a corruption scandal. Our Vienna correspondent, Bethany Bell, reports on the prospects of the party and its controversial leader, Herbert Kickl.
The Freedom Party, the FPÖ, is riding high, tapping into concerns about migration, inflation, the war in Ukraine, and anger over the way the COVID-19 pandemic was handled.
Noch nie war die Chance so groß.
The chances have never been so great, one of its campaign videos says. As Volkskanzler, People's Chancellor, Herbert Kickl will do everything to give you back your freedom, security and your peace. Let's build Fortress Austria.
Bauen wir gemeinsam die Festung Österreich.
The term Volkskanzler was used to describe describe Adolf Hitler in the 1930s, something that worries Kiekel's opponents. The political analyst Thomas Hofer told me Kiekel's rhetoric has always been very harsh and divisive, but he says that even if the far-right party wins, it won't necessarily be able to form a coalition government.
Of course, it would be a totally new situation in the history of the Second Republic in Austria, because the Freedom Party came close a couple of times, but was never in first place, at least not on the general election level. And of course, it would be a kind of shockwave, but doesn't mean if they come in first that they also will have the chancellor. This is by no means clear.
Herbert Kiekel, the Freedom Party leader, is widely disliked by other parties in Austria. The climate action minister Leonore Gewessler of the Greens says they won't form a government with the FPÖ.
One thing is very clear for the Greens, we will not work in a coalition with the far right. So the FPÖ, who denies climate change, who only works on dividing our society, on spreading fear and conspiracy theories even, that is no coalition possibility for us.
That position is shared by the opposition Social Democrats.
Wenn ein Sturm aufzieht, dann schau nicht auf die Äste.
And the Conservative People's Party, led by Austria's current Chancellor Karl Nehammer, has repeatedly excluded joining a Kiekel-led government, although he hasn't ruled out an alliance with the rest of the Freedom Party. He's seeking to attract centrist voters with slogans like Vote Stability.
Und Stabilität. Wir müssen miteinander reden und versuchen einander zu verstehen.
But Austria is deeply split, especially when it comes to migration. Margot Sterner is from Wels, west of Vienna.
You don't really feel safe in your own country anymore. But then you're being branded as right-wing just because you think about the safety of your own people, the children and the women.
But Elisabeth Scherzenlehner, who's a German teacher from Vienna, says she's worried about the rise of the far right.
I think FPÖ is a really strong negative voice. I think there's no mercy if they will come to rule Austria.
Bethany Bell reporting from the Austrian capital, Vienna. More than 60 people have died in Nepal and dozens of others are missing after torrential rain triggered widespread flooding and landslides. Most of the deaths took place in the Kathmandu Valley, where the swollen Bagmati River flooded more than 200 homes. Lipika Pelham reports.
3,000 rescue workers have been using helicopters and rubber boats to help people stranded on rooftops and elevated ground. Kathmandu has experienced power cuts after the main transmission line was damaged by the floods. Most of the rivers across 40 districts have swollen and submerged homes, bridges and roads. Rescuers say they have saved around 1,000 people, but many remain unaccounted for after landslides swept away their homes.
Lipika Pelham. Saudi Arabia has carried out its highest annual number of executions in more than 3 decades after it put 3 people to death on Saturday, taking this year's figure to 198. Charles Anyagolu reports.
The record number of executions in Saudi Arabia come amid a sharp increase in death sentences carried out against drug offenders, with 53 so far this year, rising from just 2 in 2023. It's drawn strident condemnation from the United Nations. The human rights group Amnesty International has also accused the Saudi authorities of weaponizing the death penalty to silence political dissent. It said the Saudi government was pursuing a relentless killing spree whilst holding grossly unfair trials, and it's called for an immediate moratorium on executions there. The oil-rich kingdom put to death the third highest number of prisoners in the world after China and Iran.
Charles Anyagolu. Police in northern Mexico have clashed with armed men who blocked a major road to demand money from drivers. Witnesses say the criminals caused panic after setting fire to trucks. Leonardo Rocha has the details.
Mexican media say the criminal group set several trucks on fire as the police approached, causing panic among drivers stuck in traffic. Most of the gang managed to escape, but at least three bodies were found next to the vehicles once the fire was brought under control. The arrest of two Sinaloa cartel leaders in the US 2 months ago seemed to have triggered a turf war between rival criminal groups in the area. More than 70 people have been killed in Sinaloa since Joaquin Guzman and El Mayo Zambada were arrested as their plane landed in Texas at the end of July.
Leonardo Rocha. With less than 6 weeks to go before the US presidential election and polls suggesting the two main contenders are neck and neck, immigration could be a decisive issue. It's also an issue the Democratic contender Kamala Harris is vulnerable on, as she's been vice president for more than 3.5 years. She's been in Arizona on the border with Mexico to pledge millions of dollars on tougher border security. But can she convince voters that she can tackle an issue that's perceived to be a strong suit for her Republican rival, Donald Trump? Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, has been finding out.
Somos amigos! Somos Samaritanos!
What were you saying?
That we're friends and we're Samaritans.
Gail Kocurek is a volunteer who drives down to the southern border to hand out food and water to migrants who are on the Mexican side.
Hola.
Hola.
As she shouts, a small group of men emerge from the undergrowth where they were waiting until nightfall before crossing into the US.
Más agua, un momento.
Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome.
One 20-year-old Mexican man, who told us to call him Miguel, explained why he feels the need to risk entering the U.S. illegally.
I only go to work. I want to help to my family for give them a better life. I want to pay taxes. I want to work by the legal way.
But you'll be in America illegally and working illegally. Why is that better than working in Mexico?
Because in the United States you can save a little more.
We were talking through a large gap in the infamous border wall. It won't be difficult for Miguel and his companions to walk over into America, but it could be dangerous. It's nearly 40 degrees, and hundreds of migrants die in the desert heat every year. Kamala Harris once called Donald Trump's beloved wall a medieval vanity project. But now she's promising more security, aware that this is her weakest electoral issue.
What's this?
This is a water trough. I put in a drinking fountain for anybody who wants to come by and get a drink of water.
Jim Chiltern is an Arizona rancher who wants to stop migrants crossing onto his enormous 50,000-acre property. But he still provides drinking water because he also doesn't want people dying on his land.
In 2023, we had 3 people die on the ranch. And how many more are out there? I mean, 50,000 acres... how many dead bodies are out there that have never been found? No one deserves to die of dehydration. It's outrageous. That's why we need to secure the border.
He has set up motion-activated cameras that show thousands of people crossing his ranch every year. And he does not believe that if elected, Kamala Harris would stop them and secure that border.
And now she's changing her mind just to get votes and lie to us. Outrageous.
Why are you so sure it's a lie?
I've seen the evidence. We've had
The landscape here in southern Arizona is vast and beautiful. It's also a key electoral battleground, territory where Ms. Harris knows she is vulnerable. That's why she's hoping to convince voters that she would get tough on immigration, which is, of course, Donald Trump's signature issue.
Sarah Smith. Now, time for a quick message from Oliver Conway.
Hi all, just a quick reminder that in the run-up to the US presidential election, we'll be doing a special podcast in collaboration with our friends at BBC Americast. But we need your help to come up with questions to put to the team in the US. So if there's anything you'd like to know, please send us an email to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk or tweet us at Global News Pod. And if possible, please record your question in a voice note. Thank you.
And thanks, Oliver. The Homeless World Cup, a football tournament for people without proper housing, has just concluded in South Korea, with Mexico winning both the men's and women's finals. Our Asia-Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow, reports.
Teams from 38 nations flew to Seoul to take part in the week-long competition, which was first held 2 decades ago. Football's world governing body, FIFA, sponsored the event for the first time this year and live-streamed matches. The aim of the tournament is to raise awareness about global homelessness and help participants change their lives. In the end, Mexico's women beat Romania and the men
well stopped, but it's taken in.
Pipped England with a goal in the dying seconds.
Mickey Brister reporting. Let's return now to our main story, Israel's killing of Hezbollah's leader. With his assessment of what the death of Hassan Nasrallah could mean for the Middle East, here's our international editor, Jeremy Bowen.
For Israel, the killing of Hassan Nasrallah is a huge victory. For more than 30 years, he had been the beating heart of Hezbollah. With the aid of his close allies in Iran, he turned the organization into a fighting force that in 2000 forced Israel to end a 2-decade occupation of South Lebanon. In 2006, he led Hezbollah as it fought Israel to a standstill. Nasrallah has been Israel's biggest single enemy. In recent years, only Yahya Sinwar, mastermind of the Hamas attack on Israel in October last year, has come close. Israel has taken the fight to Hezbollah after almost a year of an attritional border war. Killing its leader, Hassan Nasrallah, is the biggest blow of all. The question now is how Hezbollah and Iran might respond. They could bide their time, or they might be concluding that if they don't hit back hard, they'll face a strategic defeat. Israel expects a response according to its armed forces. They've banned gatherings of more than 1,000 people. The Middle East has entered a period of even greater uncertainty and danger. Fear of what might happen next is why the US and Israel's Western allies tried to persuade Mr. Netanyahu to accept a 21-day ceasefire. They wanted to create a pause for diplomacy. It is too late for that now.
That was our international editor, Jeremy Bowen. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Darren Garrett. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.